Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. Today, we're diving into one of the most crucial moments in the lead up to the American Revolution, the First Continental Congress, held in 1774. We're going to explore how the meeting took shape and focus on Virginia's contributions. To help us understand, I'm joined by John Ragosta, a fellow at Virginia Humanities and a leading expert on early American history. In the lead up to the First Continental Congress, colonial resistance was still a patchwork of different ideas and ambitions. Each colony had its own set of grievances and ways of approaching the British crown. But as tensions heightened, particularly with the Coercive Acts, a new sense of unity was born. And it's Virginia's involvement that helped set the stage for what would eventually lead to open rebellion. Virginia, in particular, had been one of the most vocal colonies in opposing British rule, as we've explored in previous episodes. For a quick refresher, as early as 1765, the Virginia House of Burgesses passed the Virginia Resolves, boldly declaring that only the colony's own assembly had the right to tax Virginians, not British Parliament. After the Boston Poor Act, Virginia's leaders took a stand again with the Day of Fasting, Humiliation, and Prayer, and a colony-wide boycott of British goods. This kind of resistance set the tone for what was to come as Virginia emerged as a leader in the push for coordinated action across the colonies.
All of these things together left people wondering, wait a minute, could this happen to us? Because they all are still proud British Empire people. We had won the French and Indian War, we're the greatest empire on earth. And so there was this conflict among Americans of what do we want to do about this? But those coercive acts, the intolerable acts, begin to make everybody start to think a little bit that maybe we're Americans rather than British.
This is where things really start to shift. What had once been separate colony-specific responses, like Massachusetts' direct protests and Virginia's boycott, began evolving into something more unified. We see this in the transition from localized meetings like the Virginia Convention to the creation of committees of correspondence. These committees of correspondence were designed to facilitate communication between the colonies, kind of like a phone tree or an email chain. These committees were critical in turning local grievances into a shared colonial cause, allowing political leaders to strategize across regional lines. They're coming to realize they've got power in one another. Now what to do with it? If you're looking at a textbook or a timeline, it might seem like one colony had the idea for the Continental Congress and then sent word to the others, and then boom, the meeting just happened. But in reality, that's not how it played out. The colonies didn't have cell phones. They weren't calling each other to coordinate in real time. Even if something happened just a few days apart, that doesn't necessarily mean one event directly caused the next. Take Virginia, for example. By the time they received word from Massachusetts suggesting a broader colonial meeting, they had already been in what is known as the First Virginia Convention and had already decided on their own to go through with non-importation. And they weren't the only ones.
All these things are building up for people, and it sort of comes to a head in the First Continental Congress. People argue about who really had the idea first. Each colony, the Massachusetts says, well, our idea. Virginia says it was our idea. Rhode Island says it was our idea. It doesn't really matter. They all agreed that we need to get together and talk about this. This is not a Massachusetts problem. And that shift, that's enormously important, that this is not a Massachusetts problem. This is an American problem.
Across the colonies, local leaders were coming to the same conclusion almost simultaneously. We can't just respond as individual colonies anymore. We need to be talking to each other. So while the First Continental Congress in 1774 feels like a single coordinated decision, it was really more like a convergence. Many different groups realizing independently that they needed to act together. That's why by late spring 1774, 9 of the 13 colonies were calling for a Continental Congress. This is a big deal. As John points out, meetings like this were not the norm.
these are not normal. I mean, we have to take a step back. People today say, well, Congress, okay, we have Congress. People get elected. No, this is not normal. You had had the Stamp Act Congress back in 1765, but in fact, the Stamp Act Congress was sort of after the fact a little bit. The protests had already started and didn't really do much. So we have the Tea Party in December 1773. We have these intolerable acts enacted sort of in the April, May period of 1774. And then the colonies react and start to agree we ought to send delegates.
At the start of the 18th century, these colonies weren't functioning like states in a single country today. They were, for the most part, insular, self-governing, and often more focused on their own local concerns than on what was happening a colony or two away. It may sound crazy to us, but people really weren't traveling between Massachusetts and Virginia the way we drive between states now. Most people lived and died in the same colony where they were born, with little interaction beyond their own borders. Until this point, the biggest connection the colonies had in common was England. They traded with Britain, they followed British laws, and many still saw themselves as British subjects first and foremost.
At the First Continental Congress, more of the delegates before that Congress had been to London than had been to Philadelphia. The empire was like a spoke in wheels. London is in the middle, and everybody relates to London. They don't relate to each other. So the mere fact that they're going to meet in Philadelphia and you bring these people together and they start to say, well, how do we react to all of this is a huge development.
On September 5th, 1774, a group of delegates from 12 of the 13 American colonies, Georgia sat this one out, gathered at Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia for the First Continental Congress. While all the delegates agreed they needed to show a united front to Britain, they were pretty divided over what that meant.
I think it's fair to think that when they went to Philadelphia, they hoped that they were going to be British citizens long term. They really had two different interests. They wanted to repair the empire. They wanted to make things right with the empire. They also wanted to protect their rights. And those two things sometimes would come into conflict. But it wasn't like black and white. They have different levels of, wait a minute, is protecting our rights more important or is returning to the British Empire more important? What's our primary focus here?
One of the Congress's first big decisions was endorsing the Suffolk Resolves put forth by Massachusetts. These resolves urged colonists to refuse to comply with the Intolerable Acts, boycott British imports, and begin forming militias. This early endorsement signaled that Congress wasn't just about words. There was real urgency and determination in the room. Now, the guys from Massachusetts were very aware of their reputations. They'd often been labeled the troublemakers of the colonies. They've already had some other drama. Think Sons of Liberty, Boston Massacre, Boston Tea Party, tarring and feathering. And then add to that the fact that the Suffolk Resolves condoned and encouraged the formation of militias. Recognizing this, they made a strategic decision to step back and allow another colony to take the lead. And where else to look than Virginia? Oftentimes, when we see words of opposition to the crown and its policies come out of Virginia, Massachusetts is the one taking it to the streets to act on them. Because of this, at this meeting, we will see the formation of a significant alliance between these two colonies. Despite Massachusetts stepping back slightly, their goals remained in sync.
Virginia is very important, and people have heard that. Well, Virginia is the largest colony. But pause on that for a moment. It's the largest colony, not only geographically, but wealth, population. The population at the time in America of the 13 colonies, the population is about 2.5 million, about 2.5 million. Of those, over 500,000 are in Virginia. So a fifth of the American population is in Virginia. 200,000 of those people are enslaved. But even the free whites in Virginia, over 300,000, is still the largest colony. The white population in Virginia is higher than Massachusetts, higher than Pennsylvania, higher than New York. So Virginia is extremely important. It's also the Old Dominion. This was the colony that had been loyal through the British Civil War until Cromwell threatens them and so on. It's the first colony. So it has this prestige that's important. And the delegation they send is extraordinary.
The Virginia delegation is made up of seven men: Peyton Randolph, Richard Henry Lee, Benjamin Harrison, Edmund Pendleton, Richard Bland, George Washington, and Patrick Henry, who were elected during the first Virginia convention. And if you need to brush up on that, listen to our conversation with Kathy Hellier in episode 3. These delegates were all white, land-owning men, certainly not diverse by today's definition, but they did represent a variety of approaches to resolving this problem with the crown.
You have Peyton Randolph becomes the president of the first and then for a period, the Second Continental Congress. He's the Speaker of the House of Burgesses in Williamsburg, just came from Williamsburg. And people have heard of him. They don't have TV, but they've heard of this guy, that he's the leader in Virginia. George Washington. George Washington's still an up-and-coming guy. He's not General Washington. He's Colonel Washington. And people have maybe heard of him. He was perhaps the highest-ranking American military official in the French and Indian War. Then you have others. You have Benjamin Harrison. Harrison is Peyton Randolph's brother-in-law. You have Richard Henry Lee, the Lee family, the Harrison family. These are the first families of Virginia. And they're powerful. They're wealthy. It's a very strong delegation from Virginia. The size and wealth and power of the Virginia delegation, people immediately recognize, oh, Virginia's taking this seriously.
Open now at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, Unbound, Free Black Virginians, an exhibition tracing the lives of free Black Virginians from 1619 to the end of slavery in 1865. Discover how these individuals claimed their freedom, built thriving communities, and navigated a society that called them free but not equal. Learn more and get tickets at virginiahistory.org.
Let's talk about this Virginia delegation. Each delegate brought a different approach. Some were ready to push back hard against the crown, and some pushed for a more moderate, calculated response. So, where better to get started than with one of the most radical of the bunch? You probably already know him as one of the most well-known speakers of the era, Patrick Henry. He was ready to roll at this meeting, and his reputation for fiery rhetoric preceded him.
The first day of the Continental Congress, Patrick Henry stands up to speak, and everybody listening says, oh yeah, I've heard of Patrick Henry. These people had never seen Patrick Henry. There's no TV, there's no television, there's no internet. They never heard Patrick Henry speak, but they had heard of Patrick Henry. And so very early in the Continental Congress, he gets up and he makes this remarkable speech. People are dumbfounded. They're sitting there with their mouths hanging open. And he says, all laws are dissolved. We are now in a state of nature. I am not a Virginian. I am an American. He was making an important speech. He was making a theoretical point, but he was also beginning to argue about, okay, where is political power in America? He had a political purpose. He was being very intentional about it. But it did speak to what was happening at the Continental Congress. People were looking around and saying, you know, people in Massachusetts and people in South Carolina are very different, but we're not that different. And this is extraordinary. And people are absolutely shocked. But it sets an important tone.
And in Henry's same more radical camp was Richard Henry Lee. And if that name sounds familiar, yes, we do mean those Lees, one of Virginia's most prominent families. And Richard does make waves in this meeting, but he tends to sort of be outshined by the glow of Patrick Henry in our historic memory.
Richard Henry Lee's there. He's a young guy, and I think he would have been viewed as one of the Henry-esque hotheads, as opposed to the Pendletons, the Harrisons, the Randolphs. But it's important that a Lee is there.
George Washington was also there, and it's clear why he had a seat at the table. In July 1774, he helped to write the Fairfax Resolves with George Mason. The Fairfax Resolves stated that colonists had these same rights as British subjects and called for representation in Parliament, control over taxation, and control over aspects of their own trade. And in the event that Great Britain wasn't going to give them these rights, the resolutions called for a General Continental Congress to represent all of the colonies, their rights, and what they were going to do about it. In the same month, George Washington also writes a private letter to Brian Fairfax, where he states, "I think the Parliament of Great Britain hath no more right to put their hands into my pocket without my consent than I have to put my hand into yours." On the more moderate side of things, we will find Peyton Randolph, a wealthy Virginia planter and politician, who was ultimately and unanimously chosen to serve as the president of this meeting.
I mean, he's Virginia. John Adams or Sam Adams might have been obvious, but it had to be a Virginian. And Massachusetts understands that. The Adams understand that. You don't want a South Carolinian. Those people are going to cause trouble. So it has to be a Virginian. And Peyton Randolph is the Speaker of the House of Burgesses. To me, it's an easy and obvious choice. I always realize it's a lot easier to say when you've read in the history book, that's the choice that's made. But it's important that he, the leader of the Virginia delegation, becomes the president of the Continental Congress.
There's also Edmund Pendleton. And don't worry, it's okay if you haven't heard of him.
Pendleton's a respected figure, but he never quite takes the limelight. He's never the guy that anyone remembers. He's sort of the ultimate establishment guy. So he's old line. By the way, he doesn't like Patrick Henry. He doesn't like the Young Bucks because they're noisy. So Pendleton is old school, but it's important that he too comes around to being a revolutionary. So when the Pendletons and the Randolphs come around, it's one thing for Henry and Lee. Those guys are crazy. They're loud. They, you know, easy for them to do this. But when the Pendletons and the Randolphs start and Harrisons start to come around to revolution, that is very important.
While there was still a desire to repair the relationship with Britain, these Virginians were becoming more and more convinced that the colonies needed to take more drastic action. As we'll see later on, they play a significant role in the creation of the Continental Association, which would serve as a collective boycott of British goods. During the First Continental Congress, delegates wrestled with the challenge of defining colonial rights and grievances, knowing that just repealing certain laws wouldn't solve the bigger issue of British overreach.
There was a big debate about what is the nature of American rights. Do they come as the natural rights of all mankind? Do they come because of our charter, the charters each of the colonies have, or do they come because we are British? And ultimately what they do, which is a wonderful lawyerly decision, they include all three. But this was actually important to these people because if they're natural rights, then Parliament can't control your natural rights. I mean, we in America now, we think of our Constitution, you know, and some of these are human rights that cannot be taken from a person. So that was a big debate. What's the nature of American rights? But the real big debate, and the one that then affects things going forward, is what do we do? What do we do about this, that Britain's interfering with our rights?
One of the most important debates centered around the question of how far the colonies should go in their opposition to Britain. Many, including Randolph and other moderates, wanted to maintain some kind of relationship with the British crown. They still hoped that the situation could be resolved without full-blown rebellion. However, figures like Patrick Henry and Richard Henry Lee were much more radical, pushing for more direct action. Remember that summary view document from the last episode? That's really gotten legs by the time we get to this convention, and people are talking about it. Ultimately, the delegates found some middle ground. They wouldn't abandon the crown, yet, but they would make their voices heard. They created a Declaration of Rights and Grievances, which served as a petition to the king to fix things, and asserted the colony's right to participate in their own government. It was really a unified statement of principles that formally declared that colonists should have the same rights as Englishmen.
The Continental Congress was going to send a petition to the king saying, King, you need to intervene. Parliament is messing around with our rights. You're the king. We're your subjects. Make this all right. And there were several drafts of that petition to the king, one of which was created by Richard Henry Lee, which was rejected by the Continental Congress as being too strident. It looked a little bit too much like independence rather than, no, we want to be members of the British Empire. The one that's adopted is important, although it's sort of in a lawyerly way. I mean, most people, yeah, okay, they have a petition of grievances. Nobody pays any attention to the list of grievances except the lawyers. And the king pays no attention whatsoever.
Okay, so these delegates have written down why they're mad and what rights mean to them. But now what? What's their action item? The discussion centers on the question, what could a new relationship with the crown look like in our ideal world? Joseph Galloway, a delegate from Pennsylvania, pitched his plan of union. Galloway's plan suggested a grand council elected by the colonies, kind of like a mini version of the British Parliament, with a crown-appointed president general to represent the king. Ultimately, the plan failed in a 6-5 vote, showing how divided the Congress was on whether reconciliation with Britain was still possible and whether or not they were willing to make compromise to get there.
it becomes complicated for some of these people because, again, they see themselves as British. Joseph Galloway, on that balance between what's most important to us, fixing the British Empire, maintaining our rights, he wants to do both, but he ends up coming down fairly strongly in the British Empire side. And he introduces a proposal that actually, when you read it in the history book, sounds not unreasonable. He said, look, each one of the colonies will elect people to this American parliament, and the king will be the king, but this American Congress will govern here. The British parliament will govern there, and then we'll have to agree on things that affect both of us. A little bit like the Commonwealth system, what's going to happen with Australia and Canada in the 19th century. And it sounds sort of reasonable. The important point, I think, is they're really struggling with how do we fix the British Empire? And Galloway, he's there. He's not opposed to the idea of a Continental Congress. He's not opposed to American rights. He's not opposed to drafting the petition to the king. He's not opposed to drafting the petition of grievances. But he's saying, okay, but how do we solve this problem going forward? Which, of course, there's the rub. He comes up with a plan that, you know, it's not up for us to judge, is it right or wrong? But he loses. He had a plan that was not Americans lose and British get to do everything. Now, Britain would not have accepted it anyway. So even if the Americans adopted the Galloway program, the king was not going to have an American parliament.
But that's another issue.
That's another issue.
So Galloway's proposal was scrapped, and the Congress doesn't end up with an actual plan for how to solve the sovereignty issue. But the Congress does get some things done. One of its most significant actions was drafting and adopting the Continental Association. Virginia played a big role in one of the Congress's biggest decisions, the Continental Association. So let's talk about it. It was a sweeping economic strategy aimed at pressuring Britain through non-importation and non-exportation. This had already been trialed on a colony-by-colony basis with mixed success, but the intercolonial boycott developed during this meeting finally had some teeth.
The association is the big debate, and it's really the big outcome from the Continental Congress. And what the association does is it says we will block imports because, okay, Britain's done the Intolerable Act. They've closed up the Port of Boston. They've eliminated the Massachusetts Charter, Administration of Justice Act, Quebec Act. We will stop importing things from Britain. They tried that with the Stamp Act. They tried that with the Townsend duties. Mixed result. And we will also stop exporting.
The agreement called for an immediate halt to British imports by December 1774, followed by a ban on exports to Britain starting in September 1775. Virginia played a key role in this decision. They argued that exports couldn't be cut off too quickly, as it would devastate farmers. And since Virginia had already passed its own trade restrictions with a delayed export ban, they were able to successfully push for a similar delay in the Continental Association.
Now, there's several big debates going on here. One is there had been efforts to block imports before, but the problem was if you do it colony by colony, so Massachusetts says we're not going to import from England. Well, then Connecticut just imports more stuff from England, and Connecticut merchants get to sell stuff into Massachusetts. New York says you want us to block things, but Philadelphia is bringing them in. So the first thing is the existence of the Continental Congress itself is extremely important because, no, we all, right? And they're looking at each other going, you guys are going to do it too. If I do it, you're going to do it, right? And so we're all going to block imports. So that's the first big debate, and they succeed in that regard. But then blocking exports became highly contested. And the reason, this is South Carolina, Virginia, causing problems again. They're saying, look, our money is all tied up in tobacco, in rice, in indigo. These are crops. They're out in the field. We're all heavily in debt because we buy too much. We live too well. We've been buying all of these commercial goods from England, and we've got to pay back our debt. So you've got to let us ship next year's crop. And there's a huge debate because people are like, what do you mean? You get to keep exporting. We're supposed to ban imports, and we're supposed to ban all exports, but you get to keep exporting. And so what ultimately is decided in South Carolina, and same thing they did in the Constitutional Convention, they're threatening to take their ball and go home. We won't play if you don't go along with us. Virginia's threatening the same thing. You know, this is really important to us. So what ultimately is decided is we're going to block imports, I believe, by December. So quite quickly. But exports get to go through the following September, which was going to give them time to export the tobacco crop and to export, and I shouldn't say all exports, tobacco and rice, but basically give them another year of harvest that they could sell. South Carolina wanted indigo in there as well, making all of the fancy blue cloths throughout Europe. And that was one thing they didn't get. They settled for rice and tobacco. But the association, that's a result that had real impact. We're going to have a continental-wide ban on British imports and a continental-wide ban next year on exports.
If Parliament didn't back off and repeal the Intolerable Acts, this boycott was set to go live on December 1st, 1774.
If you put yourself in the perspective of someone from London, the British merchants understood that the colonies had economic power. I mean, the Stamp Act protests had been effective. The Townsend protests, some yes, some no, because they weren't continent-wide. But if you're a British merchant, you're looking at this going, I don't like this. This idea the whole colony is going to get together and start deciding what's in American interest and making economic decisions based on American interest. And you certainly don't like this if you're the British government, because you had just done the Massachusetts Government Act, which says, no, the governor, the royal governor is going to be appointing everybody. Well, these people are appointing themselves. There's no American Continental Congress as far as the King of Britain's concerned, as far as Parliament's concerned. So I don't think they like it. How seriously do they take it? I think they have to feel the economic bite.
All right. These men have planned for a continental-wide ban on imports and exports. But how can they pull this off? They had some very real challenges that they were facing. They were working across a vast area, and they were working within an extra-legal body that technically had no government power. So this is something that's really critical for them to hash out while they're still all in the room together, because a boycott that's not well-coordinated is what they've tried before, and it would be an exercise in futility to try it again. In order to enforce this, local and colony-wide committees of inspection were established. They were responsible for monitoring shipments, ensuring compliance, and even cracking down on extravagance. Goodbye, lavish luxury goods. These committees would become the backbone of a new independent government system.
They've got this association. We're going to block imports and exports. But then they do something that's critically important. As historians, we can look back and see how things developed. We have an association. We're all going to agree not to import, and we're going to agree not to export after this date. How do you enforce it? How do you enforce it? There's no law. A Continental Congress can't draft laws. They have no legal authority. There's no police force. There's no customs service. We don't have a Department of Homeland Security. And so they say in the association that each county should have a committee that's going to enforce this. And the idea was the counties, you know, you would elect each county, because there's county governments. You have magistrates in Virginia. You have different officials in the different colonies. So they're going to have a committee that's going to go run around. And if they see a merchant violating this association, they're going to publish their name. Well, they don't say they're going to tar and feather them, but it might happen. But they're going to publish their name. They're going to go to them. They're going to try to do this. The reason this is so important, and again, it's sort of hard to put yourself in the mindset. There is no government other than the British government. There is no police force. There is no militia. It all comes from Britain. It's all king, parliament, to governors. It's all British, all part of the British Empire. Because of these committees, you ended up with, I believe it's between 3,000 to 5,000 committee members enforcing the association all over America. Now, it's all white men at this point, but 3,000 to 5,000 officials. And when you create a new government, you're going to need officials. You're going to need members of the legislature. You're going to need governors. You're going to need lieutenant governors. You're going to need sheriffs. You're going to need all these officials. And now many of them are going to be the same people from before, but not all. Many of those people were loyalists. They may be gone. And you've dramatically expanded the number of people who are officially engaged. And you've also expanded, because 3,000 to 5,000 is a lot more than you've had before. There are going to be some tradesmen. They're not going to all be wealthy gentry. We're going to have some tradesmen. We're going to have some local lawyers, local businessmen. And that then will become extremely important in the revolution, because these people are going to help rally support for the revolution. They're going to help recruiting. They're going to help financing the revolution. So the association, as I said, becomes, to me, the really critical outcome, not only because we're blocking imports, we're going to block exports next year, Britain's going to start to feel that, but it's also, it's America. It's creating a government. Continental Congress does eventually have legal authority. Sort of how we get there is a little complicated to explain. It's a little bit, you know, presto magic, but it develops because we've got this association. We've all agreed to it. Every county is going to have people who are going to be responsible for it. And so we get the committees of safety and so on that happen throughout the colonies. And those committees then become enormously important building blocks for the revolution and then ultimately for the United States.
So the big takeaways of this first Continental Congress are the Suffolk Resolves, the Declaration of Rights and Grievances, and this Continental Association. Perhaps the most fateful decision of the First Continental Congress was agreeing to reconvene if Britain failed to address their grievances. The Second Continental Congress was set for the following spring, giving Britain time to respond.
They hoped that England would see their errors, they would eliminate all of these terrible acts, and everything would go, we'd be members of the British Empire, and we love it, God save the king. But they realized that may not happen. And they realized we're now a continental Congress. And so the mere fact that at the end they said, and by the way, we're going to meet again in May of 1775, if necessary, is an important point.
By the time the delegates returned for the Second Continental Congress in May of 1775, the situation had escalated dramatically. Many were literally on their way to Philadelphia when news broke of the battles of Lexington and Concord, the first shots of the American Revolution. What had begun as a fight for fair treatment under British rule was quickly turning into something far bigger. It makes you wonder, when did this shift happen? When did the split between Great Britain and the colonies become inevitable? Historians don't necessarily agree about this.
I tend to be a traditionalist in the idea that it's not inevitable until Lexington and Concord. After you got a couple hundred dead redcoats and colonists, that's inevitable. But what could Britain have done? There's a problem if you're British. We're just talking about the problem as the Americans, because we have these two things we want to balance. If you read in the 18th century, you read during the revolutionary era, we talk about Edmund Pendleton, Randolph, Jefferson. They're very interested in the Glorious Revolution. Okay. There's very different understandings of what the Glorious Revolution was. The British say, well, the whole point of the Glorious Revolution is Parliament's running everything. Don't you understand? Parliament's in charge. Parliament basically appointed a new king and queen. From the American perspective, it's no, the people are in charge, not the king. And it's the people's rights. And yeah, it's reflected by Parliament, but it was because the people, the king works for the people. You know, Jefferson in his summer review, we haven't gotten to Jefferson's summer review in 1774, the king works for the people. So that's Jefferson's understanding of the Glorious Revolution. That's the American understanding of the Glorious Revolution. In Britain, if your understanding of the world is Parliament is supreme, Parliament is the sovereign, Parliament runs the British Empire, the king has been pushed back, very hard to come to a resolution.
That's it for today's episode of Revolution Revisited. In the next and final episode of this season, we're finally making it to 1775. That's right. Lexington and Concord, Patrick Henry's famous Give Me Liberty speech, and Lord Dunmore getting a little dramatic with the Williamsburg Gunpowder Magazine. A special thank you to John Ragosta for sharing his insights into the Continental Congress. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your friends. For more episodes and resources, including the primary sources mentioned in this episode, check out our website at virginiahistory.org/podcast.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Nicole Martirana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Don't miss your chance to see Give Me Liberty, Virginia and the Forging of a Nation at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture before it closes on January 4th. This special exhibition commemorates the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Discover Virginia's leading role in the American Revolution and how both iconic and everyday people helped forge a new nation. Tickets at virginiahistory.org.